Thank you. First of all, I would like to thank Dr. Deng and also Dr. Rasmussen for having invited me to come to this meeting here and give an overview of what we are doing. And so that's, of course, quite different from what you're used to, working with salts. I'm an inhalation toxicologist, so I'm working with particles that are airborne and being inhaled and may be doing some damage depending on what they consist of. Secondly, I apologize also that I deprive you of the break. And because of my tight connection I have at the airport to get off to Europe. So I would like to start with just introducing nanoscale materials here. And you may be familiar with some of them, for example, buckyballs, 1 nanometer, cast of 60 carbons consisting little balls, and also carbon nanotubes consisting of several layers of carbon sheets here surrounding each other here, single-walled, double-walled, multi-walled carbon nanotubes, and then different types of other materials here as shown here. And they all are in the range between 1 and 100 nanometer approximately if you look at the whole scale here. So very tiny particles indeed. And when this field of nanotechnology was developed, there were really a lot of expectations here, and I've pointed here out the bright here. So many different industries are making use of those now, and there were a lot of predictions what the benefits will be doing. You see also here food and feed industry, but also they are being used and have been tried to be used for soil and water remediation. A big field is also nanomedicine, as shown here. But then there's also a potential dark side, the consumer fears, if they are perceived ones or real ones here, with respect to their safety. When people are exposed, and they certainly will be exposed, and there may be inadvertent exposure, there's environmental contamination occurring. So we are trying within nanotoxicology to get at this issue here to find out what is really going on and what are the real versus perceived risks. Now, you may be familiar, some of you, with this Gartner hype cycle, so-called, here, and I adapted that to nanotechnology, where in the beginning there's some kind of a trigger, and then the really extreme excitement and predictions what might be there, for example, here, this expectation of plans to develop a space elevator from a platform in the ocean up to a space station consisting of carbon nanotubes because they are so extremely strong and light material. Of course, that will never happen here. And then there is some reduced expectations occurring here. And with the second phase, and I think that we are now with improving our expectations and also increasing productivity coming out of this. And transferred it also to nanotoxicology. And here we are seeing the same thing with respect to the potential hazard. And there are a lot of perceptions, and most of them are misconceptions, summing up in all nanoparticles are toxic. And I give you here some headlines that you could see in the public press here. Nanoparticles kill workers, cause cancer, damage DNA, soften your brain, and cause lung damage, cause genetic Alzheimer's, and so on. And are carbon the next asbestos? And in short, nanoparticles are cute little assassins. And so I think we are, hopefully we have overcome this return to science here and appreciate what's really going on here and that we are in this segment here of this hazard, of this hype cycle, coming to a realistic assessment of the hazard as well as the risk here. Give an example here of a study, just a couple of those, that was done with nanotitanium dioxide particles here, given intranasally into mice, and they caused a lot of brain damage here, inflammatory effects in the brain, also in the olfactory bulb in the brain in particular here, resulting in oxidative damage, increased TNF-alpha. And this study was heralded as a prime study here, as a landmark study. Now, if you look at the doses that were applied, that was instillation, a bolus-type instillation of 7.5 milligram into the mouse, which is about 17 grams into a human nose. And that is 17 grams. If you put that into your nose, you will probably have a lot of headaches and a lot of other things. So we need to be very, very careful about such studies here, and that is continuously going on, in particular also with in vitro studies. And just an example. Now, there's another example I want to give you. These are carbon nanotubes here, about 60 nanometer in diameter, 60 to 80. they can be very long, and this is the material for the space elevator. And recently, there's three studies raised attention here, and they all found when they injected these carbon nanotubes intraperitoneally, directly into the peritoneal cavity of mice, they induced mesothelioma, acting like asbestos, also this fibershite material here. And that, of course, raised some great concern here. Doses, again, was another issue here, and also the application method. But anyway, NIOSH group last year published a study where they gave nanotubes, these multiple nanotubes, to mice by oropharyngeal aspiration, we call it, directly into the trachea. And they found, indeed, that some of these tubes here can get access into the pleural cavity, where mesothelioma in human asbestos workers has been found. And this, again, is another potential confirmation that they may be getting there. Of course, what we don't know, do they do to the same degree when they are physiologically inhaled? That's what we are working on in others as well. So these studies then came raised in this suggestion here. And what I'm showing here is asbestos mesothelioma cases in Hong Kong, a study by Tse et al. And with the use of asbestos then, and going down the use because of the recognition of its danger zones, an increase with a long, long latency period of 40 years, an increase in mesothelioma. And are we dealing with something like this? Which certainly is a good question here. Now let's go into some general facts here. If we are looking at airborne particle concentrations here at a low concentration of just 10 picograms per centimeter cubed, pretty clean air. We have probably quite a bit more here in this room at the moment here. And if that would all be 5 nanometer particles of unit density, that means 153 million per centimeter cubed, huge concentration. And even 20 nanometer particles here, 2.4 million per centimeter cubed. And of course, the bigger ones, there's much, much less. And with synchrony with that here, the surface area also increases quite dramatically here, as you can see here. And the more surface area, the higher the reactivity. Just to give you an example here, surface molecules as particle size as put down by Fissan et al. Here, and you see here that really significant increase, exponential increase here below 100 nanometer particles in terms of surface air molecules, which means increased reactivity, chemical reactivity, but also biological reactivity. There's an older study of ours where we used fine TiO2, about 200-250 nanometer, and ultra-fine TiO2, gave that into the lung of rats here at different doses, and you see here clearly the fine TiO2, the larger ones, caused the dose-response relationship with respect to an inflammatory response expressed here as percent neutrophils. And whereas the ultra-fine, the fine ones, had a much steeper dose-response curve. And if you express it by number, the dose here, there's a huge difference, obviously. But if you use the surface area here, then all the same data fit very nicely on the same dose-response curve, indicating again that the surface area is a good metric, a dose metric to correlate and compare responses of different nanomaterials here. Now let's talk a little bit about the position when they are inhaled and their fate in the lung here. And it's convenient to divide the lung, the respiratory tract, into three areas here: the nasopharyngeal area, the tracheobronchial area, the conducting airways down to the terminal bronchioli, and then the alveoli. And if you look at the deposition efficiency, at the deposition fraction of inhaled particles of different sizes here, from 100 nanometer to 1 nanometer in particular, you see here that during nasal breathing, most of the very small particles deposit in the nasopharyngeal region, the upper respiratory tract. About 10 to 15 nanometer particles have a deposition peak of around for these particles in the tracheobronchial tree, and the alveolar region here, 20 nanometer particles have a very high deposition efficiency. About 50% of those inhaled will be depositing in the alveolar region here. So that seemingly means that the alveolar region gets the most. But you need to consider few things here. If you look at the tracheobronchial tree here and the alveolar region here, there's a big difference, a huge difference in terms of surface area here. This is pretty straightforward here, going down here. And then we have all the alveolar here, so there's a huge surface area. And if you express the deposition then in terms of per unit surface area, as is done here, comparing human and rats, for the extrathoracic region, at a certain concentration here, 100 microgram per meter cube inhaled, simulated inhaled over 8 hours, at the cis at a concentration of 100 microgram per meter cube, in the extrathoracic and the nasopharyngeal region, you get per unit surface area the highest deposition, followed by the tracheobronchial tree, and in the alveolar region, it's a very low, less than 1 nanogram per centimeter square deposition efficiency. So this you have to recall, but you, of course there are additional differences. Anyway, just to point out that all regions of respiratory tract certainly will be dosed by inhalation of nanoparticles to different degrees, and the effects, of course, we are working on it to see what does it mean when they get to the different regions. With respect to the fate of the nanoparticles here, getting into the body by different routes, GI tract, oral, or respiratory tract, or perhaps even the skin, although the data are very slim here, it appears that the blood is a nice distributing plenum, as shown here, from where the particles, these tiny particles, can get basically throughout the body in any organ here. However, one thing we need to consider, there are a few studies out there that the translocation rates are very, very low indeed. So it's about 1 or 2% of those that are depositing in the respiratory tract getting into the blood circulation to then further distribute to other organs. And of course, it doesn't mean that they don't do anything, but just to put it into perspective, what the dose levels might be, specifically also for in vitro testing here. With respect to elimination here, we know that the GI tract from the blood via the liver, hepatobiliary excretion here, the bile tract, is one of the excretion routes. And of course, the kidney, up to a certain size, about 6 nanometer particles, can also be excreted via the kidney. We don't know much about the central nervous system, where particles also get into, and that's one field we are also working on to find out what are the elimination pathways in that organ here. Here I give you an overview about the importance of physical chemical properties of nanomaterials in general for toxicology. And it's not just the size and size distribution, the shape. I mentioned the fibrous material, like the nanotubes, is very, very important here. And there could be other shapes. We were talking this morning about smectite. These are plates, and nobody knows yet how they will behave when they are airborne here. Very important question for sure. Agglomeration, aggregation state can make a big difference. And then, of course, very important surface properties, not just the area, the charge of the surface, the reactivity, the chemical, biological reactivity, the chemistry with respect to coatings, contaminants, and also potential defects here make all a big difference. Solubility, specifically in vivo solubility, is important, as well as crystallinity. And all these properties can change with how the particles are made, how they are generated, and they change also when they're introduced into the organism. And this is one example I would like to emphasize here, the modification of nanoparticles' surface properties when they enter the organism, translocate across barriers and entering cells, and moving also in the environment, in environmental media, and I'm not the expert there, but there are a lot of people working on this as well. And this goes back to an old concept here, the concept of differential adsorption here. And that indicates that the nanoparticle physical properties, physical chemical properties I mentioned before, together with what they are experiencing in a specific body compartment, a respiratory tract, a GI tract, or in the blood circulation, this together determines then which proteins and lipids are adsorbed or also desorbed on those particles. There's a continuous process ongoing here, and which then furthermore determines the distribution across barriers and into specific target organs. A wide field, and also very useful for for nanomedicine, when you would like to target a certain organ with certain particles for therapeutic purposes or also diagnostic purposes. This concept has more recently been further developed by different groups. Here's an example from the Dublin group, which is a forerunner in this field here. And they did a lot of studies with in vitro studies so far, finding out which protein complexes are formed with nanoparticles from plasma, for example. And they suggested and found that there are two layers of so-called coronas. One is an inner layer, a hard corona, on the particles that forms. And this is a very slow exchanging area here, where proteins are very, very stable over many hours, in contrast then to an outer weakly interacting protein layer, where there's a rapid exchange going on with the environment, with the surrounding proteins here. And in any case, there's certainly over a period of the life slow exchange as well of the hard corona ongoing, but like I said, and what this group is suggesting, that takes a much longer time here. So they conclude then that nanoparticle corona is really the defining property for the interactions with the tissues, with cells, and so that these nanoparticles interact with cells by their not with the surface per se, but with the nano object specified by the size, by the shape, and by the structure of its protein corona, which I think is very important. And what we are still looking for, what we still need confirmation of, is how is that going on in vivo. How can we confirm that in vivo here? So this is what Walczyk and all concluded here with the respect to the inner, to the soft corona here, these proteins here rapidly exchanging with the proteins in the plasma or in tissue fluids here, as opposed to the hard corona here, proteins staying on there for a long time and not readily exchanging with the surrounding proteins here. Let me briefly address another issue that's of translocation to the central nervous system here. So if you have inhaled nanoparticles depositing in the lower respiratory tract or the nasal region here, there are several different pathways by which they could travel. One is through the lymphatic system into the blood and from there then across the blood-brain barrier into the brain. However, the blood-brain barrier is extremely tight, so it's very unlikely that particles easily get through it unless you destroy the blood-brain barrier or unless you put specific proteins on it, which one group in Germany has done. And there's also a pathway along nerves into the central cerebrospinal fluid here, and there again the particles have to overcome the cerebrospinal brain barrier here, which also is not easy to overcome here. So I will focus in a couple of slides here on this pathway here directly via neurons into the central nervous system here. If you look at the human nasal component here, we have the olfactory mucosa here, and very closely nearby across the bony plate, the cribriform plate, the olfactory bulb at the bases of the brain here, connected by neurons here. So this one of the of the brain nerves, basically, that is located outside the brain. Embedded are these neurons in the nasal cells, between the nasal cells, stretching out dendrites into the nasal lumen, and via the cilia picking up smell molecules here. And then they connect to the brain via these axons, as shown here. And this has been in early studies shown to be a pathway, for example, for viruses, a polio virus, to travel into the brain. So if you look at the anatomy here, the olfactory bulb is an organ existing on both sides. The right side will be supplied by the right nostril, the right nose, and the left side by the left one. So we did a study where we occluded one nostril, the right nostril, in rats and let them inhale ultrafine particles, 30 nanometer manganese oxide particles, and then looked what gets into the olfactory bulb. And as you can see here in the occluded model here, nothing gets into the right olfactory bulb, and we got significant accumulation of manganese in the left olfactory bulb, clearly showing the translocation via these neurons into the central nervous system here. And when we did a longer study with free debriefing rats here of 12-day exposure, you see this huge accumulation of manganese in the olfactory bulb as opposed to what's in the lung. And, of course, it's soluble also there. And you see also in some brain regions where some increases of manganese in the striatum, frontal cortex, in the cerebellum, even in the back. And in those regions where this manganese signal was found, we saw also increased level of inflammatory cytokines such as TNF-alpha, and also the protein was highly increased, and of course other cytokines like MIP-1, GFAP, and so on, also antioxidants, which were all increased in these brain regions. So indeed there's some effects were seen in terms of inflammation. And what does it mean for humans? We don't know yet for sure, but I point out welders that are exposed to welding fumes at manganese oxide concentration of nanoparticles in these fumes, which are actually higher than what we gave to the rats. And there is, and you see the size distribution here of these particles in the breathing zone of welders. And again, there are these ultra-fine or nano-sized particles to a high degree occurring there. And there is some preliminary study by Rossette and co-workers showing out that Parkinsonism appears to be an early onset in welders about 20 years earlier than the general population, and which still needs some confirmation. I would like to also address a few thoughts about toxicity testing of nanomaterials. And of course, what our major objective is to eventually be able to perform some risk assessment. In order to do so, we need to have information about hazard identification, hazard characterization, as well as about exposure, what's going on at the humans at the workplace, in the laboratory, or just consumers when they're using nanoproducts, products that contain nanomaterials. And so with respect to the hazard identification characterization processes, in vitro studies as well as animal studies are essential, as we had heard also before here. And this is a very complex slide here. A long-term goal, for example, would be also to eventually come up with in silico models that we don't need to use animals, which would be really a major goal for everything. At the moment, we cannot do that. And what I would like to do, just point out a few things about animal studies, dosing of animals with nanomaterials, by inhalation, which would be the most physiological mode, versus instillation here, which is a mode by which you instill material directly into the respiratory tract and overcome this much more complicated and also expensive inhalation model. And what the differences are, I can show you here. So this, from my colleague in Germany, here we collaborate with him as well, is a lung that had inhaled, a rat lung, that had inhaled ultra-fine 20 nanometer radioactive iridium particles. And you see here the nice distribution throughout the lung, very well dispersed here. And in contrast then, the instillation of the same material here, where it was directly instilled into the lung, and these both studies show that there is more central deposition here, high concentrations here, but not as much in the periphery of the lung, or also another method for bolus-type delivery, oral pharyngeal aspiration, which is simply pulling out the lung of an anesthetized rat, obviously putting a droplet on the back of the tongue, and then the animal makes a gasp and sucks the whole material into the lung. Here too, you see there's much more central deposition, also in the conducting air within the trachea, quite a bit is there, which you don't see as much here, and then the accumulated amount here in the central region, in the central lung. In some cases, you get even some in the stomach, as shown here, when the animals partly also swallow the material. So there's a big difference. And we set out and I started to compare really the responses that we might have to expect to, in this case, ultra-fine nanoTi2 particles when we administer the same dose by either instillation or inhalation. Of course, what it means is, in one case, we give a bolus type delivery versus the inhalation, the aerosol, and it's it means also a high dose rate. It's all of a sudden there within a fraction of a second by bolus, and the low dose rate over several hours with the aerosol delivery. And then also what it means that in most cases for the bolus type delivery, you have to prepare somehow the material to make it well dispersed. We heard in the previous talk that dispersion is an important component, for example, for adsorption, and that is also the case here, versus pristine in the aerosol, and then the more central versus more peripheral lung deposition. So this summarizes briefly our two methodologies here. We use Fischer rats here. The nanoparticle was the TiO2, a famous P25 anatase, there's an A missing here. And we wanted to deposit 200 microgram with both methods into that animal here. Used the inhalation in whole body exposure chambers to have the animals inhale this, and intratracheal instillation, as I mentioned before. They were differently prepared, either just in physiological saline, where they are not well dispersed, or we used a DPPC, dipalmethyl phosphatidylcholine, which is a part of the lung surfactant in the lung to disperse the particles very nicely in combination with albumin here. And that was a specific aerosolizer with we used a sonication system, so-called Capron sonication system. For the inhalation, we used either just 4-hour inhalation and or also a 4 times 4-hour inhalation over 4 days, and looked at the deposited dose and the inflammatory response in the lung. So the result can be very brief only. First, the particle sizes, the hydrodynamic size of the suspension for saline suspended is pretty big, as you can see here. That's nanometers. And in the with the dispersant here, we are much lower here, about 500 nanometer. And in the aerosol, the aerodynamic size is about close to 800 nanometer, 900 nanometer, as shown here. And when we looked at the responses and in terms of the inflammatory cells that we can lavage out 24 hours later here, what you would expect is that with the well-dispersed material, you see the biggest response, because that's what it is done for, to get the individual components interacting with tissues. But what you see here is that the with the dispersed material get actually a lower response than with the very crudely dispersed material in saline here, to get the highest response here in terms of the inflammatory cells. And with respect to inhalation, very low, just a modest inflammatory response after the 4-hour inhalation, and no significant inflammation here when it was given 4 times in a row to deposit the same amount of 200 microgram in the lungs. And just to give you an example here, this is after the instillation in saline here, the lavage cells. These are all macrophages, which is just the normal, what you would like to see. And these here are all the neutrophils here, the polymorphic nuclear cells here, and there are lots of those after saline instillation, where we get this high inflammatory response. And also should point out here, you see here the Ti2 particles, the black dots distributed in the material here in the macrophages. And when we looked at the 4 times 4-hour exposure over 4 days, you see again the macrophages, a normal picture, but no neutrophils, no polymorphic nuclear field cells. And still you see the Ti2 is well taken up by the macrophages here, but that does not cause a response and dramatic differences. So if you compare then the different dose rates of delivery here, between these here and this in particular here, there's a difference between 30,000 to 100,000-fold difference how quickly the material is delivered to the lung, which makes obviously a big difference. The cells can simply not adapt to this high dose and have much more time to do so with inhalation. So this is graphically shown here, the dose rate here, how much micrograms per minute are given here by instillation, huge dose rate, the response here very high, and by 4-hour inhalation or 4 times 4-hour inhalation here. And so this needs to be considered. Through this cartoon, a friend of mine, he just showed the difference between a dose rate, and you can imagine that the mechanism by which the cause effects here are very, very different, and that is a main concern that I have. So let me come also to some research needs here that we need to pursue and are being pursued here in present studies here with respect to effects, environmental effects of nanomaterials, both in the environment but also in humans, of course, and looking at this whole thing from the sources, different exposure pathways to the receptor, either humans or the environment, to do a risk assessment, which would be the goal, and maybe also eventually coming up with some predictive models. And so a major aspect is here to look at the whole life cycle of materials here. What happens to them when they are produced from the cradle to the grave previously, when they're shipped to consumers, when they're made into nanomaterials, when they're disposed of, and there are all different points where releases can occur, and also associated dispersion transformations will occur in different media, such as the air when they're taken into the organism, then in water, soil, sediments. And so we then, I pointed out before, need to try to get as much as we can information about exposure, both in the environment, in humans, and also perform hazard characterization, ecotoxicological studies, human toxicological studies, to be able to characterize the risk and do a risk assessment here. And then sometime in the future, and I don't know how long it might take here, with the help of bioinformatics, maybe we'll be able to predict nanomaterials' effects by their just by the chemistry and knowledge about physical chemical properties. So and this addresses mainly your group here with respect to soil scientists, which I am not, obviously. Here, the interaction of materials getting into the soil via the air or via spillages and deposition onto the soil here, getting into the water, into the aquifers at the bottom here, and into plants and animals, and also incorporated into the food chain. These are all very important issues. At the moment, there are two major centers, UCLA and Duke Universities, that look at these interactions here, where a lot of things are happening along the lines I tried to outline here, transformation, interactions in the environment, in the body, and so on, to get some well-founded scientific information about the real risks of nanomaterials here. So I repeat this here again, here as a final slide here, that the risk is not to be associated just with hazard, but it's a function of both hazard and exposure here, as I find out here. And with that, I close and acknowledge the funding sources as well as all our collaborators in these studies over the years. Thank you very much for your attention. Yeah.
And I wonder whether that has anything to do with your exposure data that you showed with the saline solution and the deep albumin. Can you invoke?
Yeah, that is a very complex issue indeed. So we, when we did the instillation study with saline dispersed and DPPC albumin dispersed, the reason for the DPPC albumin dispersion was that that is a normal, if you will, environment in the lung when they're getting into the deep lung, into the alveolar region. So by giving that beforehand, we thought, and in fact it's not our proposal, it comes from the NIOSH group, they thought that doing doing something that is happening in the real world anyway, so let's do it before we give it to the animals. Now the problem is, of course, when you inhale a particle, it's a pristine particle, has supposedly nothing on it, and then it interacts in the lung with those elements, with different lipids, with proteins, and it's not just DPPC and albumin. There are many other things. It depends on the affinities, how well and how much is absorbed on these particles, and that happens in the lung. And then when they translocate across the barrier here into the capillaries, into the blood circulation in the interstitium, some other environment will be interacting with them. So there will be an exchange of those and the blood again and so forth. So when you pre-coat those particles here, you already do something which has altered the particle per se. It's no longer the pristine particle. And if that particle that has been coated, pre-coated with DPPC and albumin exactly behaves the same way as a pristine particle in the lung, I'm not sure. I doubt it, rather. And that is the problem there. In addition, of course, quite obviously, all these bolus-type deliveries, as I tried to point out, the huge dose rate, the cells simply don't have any time to adapt to that. They are overwhelmed with this thing of the sandbag. Kidding you, yeah? So these are all concerns that certainly I have when people like to use instillation and aspiration. We do that too. And I think it's great and good to get to identify a hazard and do some hazard ranking. But if you want to use those data for risk assessment, that you can do.
I have one question.
Yeah.
How about some lithium nanoparticles, such as in your environment, you also have a lot of nanooxides, a lot of, say, elephant immobilized. What are main health effects?
What kind of particles?
Iron oxides.
Oh, iron oxide, yeah. Yeah, the zero-valent iron oxide particles have been used for soil remediation. You may know that, yes. And there are studies certainly out there that iron will induce oxidative stress with the Haber-Weiss reaction, for example. So that's well known. And it depends very much on what form of iron it is, if it's hematite or magnetite or other ions. And the concern certainly would be that even if the in vivo solubility is quite low, there may be some release of ions, of iron ions, that can then induce these oxidative stress reactions. The strange thing is there are studies that have been done with nanotubes, multi-walled carbonate tubes, which had some ion contaminants from the manufacturing process as catalysts still on those materials, and studies so far, although again these were all bolus type studies, they did not show that it did make a major difference. So I still would be careful and would like to see studies with physiological exposure if it comes to airborne material, namely by inhalation, compare iron containing nanotubes with materials that are cleaned up.
Thank you.